Session number 12390, George Sakaguchi, Reel 3.
And this is Reel 3? Yes, you're telling me now about your army, okay. Aren't you, George, yeah.
I was just talking about the literacy, see. But in 1946, I went to a place called Camp Atterbury, Indiana, and this was an induction station. And at that time, the army said that they wanted everybody to at least be literate to fourth or fifth grade or something like that. Okay. And I was surprised that there was anybody in the United States who couldn't read or write or understand at the fifth grade level. I was shocked because I thought, because in California, I never met anybody that couldn't read or write because we had to go to school until we were 18. But when I came back east, like I said, my mother-in-law started teaching school when she was out of high school. And down in the southeast United States, down in Mississippi, Alabama, they didn't care if you go into school or not. And I was really shocked that these people so. But all our parents were, they were literate as far as the Japanese language is concerned. But, so when I look back, that I think because Japan, the Japanese people, the Japanese country made sure that everybody could, I think that this one made sure that our parents made sure that we could read or write over here. You know, we were well educated. I have, I had heart problems and I was used to go to a Jewish cardiologist. And in the Jewish culture, they're just as adamant in having the kids educated and things like that. And
yes. I was wondering also, you know, the fact that you had family in Japan, what you thought when the atomic bomb was dropped. You know, I wonder how you reacted to that.
They were there in Osaka. My two sisters in Osaka, and the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, which is considerable away. Nagasaki, when they dropped the second one, Nagasaki a little bit closer. But surprisingly, my sisters went over to Japan in the early 30s, and it wasn't until 86 or 87 that I saw them again for the first time. And we talked, and they said that because Japan was gearing up, you know, they were very, very militaristic over there anyway, but that because there were Japanese people with American citizenship, they were ostracized in Japan. They told me, said, well, you're an American, you're eating our food, you know, and a lot of them couldn't get work, but fortunately or unfortunately, they were on my grandfather's farm, and they could work there, and they didn't start. But, back when I was born, our parents registered us with the Japanese government, especially the men. So we had dual citizenship, and I think England used to do that too. I can remember a history teacher in high school said that the United States and England almost went to war over this back in 19, you know, because the English ships were stopping the American ship, and if you were English, you had to go. But, and so that, for there was a period of that where the Japanese people in Japan felt that we were traitors, that we would fight for America but wouldn't fight for Japan. Because, you know, Japan is just made up of Japanese, right? 99% of the people in Japan were, well, we have people of all ethnic backgrounds and all that. And so they don't really understand the makeup of America.
Yes, I wonder how you feel today as well, George. I know this is going off the war a bit, but, you know, this 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor is coming up. And, you know, I read your newspapers and watch the news, and there's a bit of sort of feeling between Japan and America, isn't there? And I wonder how, you know, you feel as a sort of someone with your
Well, I'm not
going to
be outside on December. I don't really worry, but I know that there are I belong to the Japanese American Citizen League, and we are making the leader there have said don't do this, or they have made press releases and stuff. But, and I've survived them all, and this may be, if the media wouldn't play it up so much, it would be just another day. When I was working, and I worked for the federal government down on 2nd and Arsenal, making maps for the Air Force, and the different guys would call me, hey, just sack, today's Pearl Harbor, there's a group that used to call me up on December the 7th, Edward, and some of them they'd hang up, they'd put signs up like, remember Pearl Harbor and all that. And what I say to them is this, and just, I said, listen, if they hadn't attacked at Pearl Harbor, we wouldn't have the good jobs with them, So, but I live in all of the white subdivision over here. I know there's the, I go out here towards Fenton where Chrysler plant is, I tell them this is UAW country. So,
but Japan's done very well, hasn't it?
They have,
economically.
And I think now, okay, I see it different from you do, okay? Or I mean, my views and ideas, what goes on, all this Japan bashing, is it different from yours? Okay. Now we have a Congressman Gephardt, who is my congressman, who I served with in the Air National Guard together. I know real well. Dick and I are real good. We know each other real well. And I told him, I said, Dick, I said, why are you this? I said, the reason you bash Japan is because you're afraid. He's afraid of what? I said, because you white folk are afraid that you're not going to be number one anymore. Oh, no, it is. I said, it is too, Dick. But he says, why do you? I said, because I have found out in mid-Missouri and in the Midwest, there are only two types of citizens. You're either white or you're black. In between, we're not American citizens, to a lot of people. And so that with all this Japan bashing on, everybody thinks, well, here's George, he's Japanese, he's partly to blame. And so when people said, people who really understand, they said, well, they talk about this Japan. And I don't say anything because I have said things and said, well, Japan, so what if it's so good? Why don't you go back? Okay. It's not hard for me to convince a lot of people that I'm not an American citizen. The sun never set on the British flag. The reason is because there's a small island and they have hardly any or no natural resources. All they've got is people that either can work or whatever, okay? And so if Japan or England had the resources and it was one big mass of land like the United States, I think that it would be different. Because the United States doesn't have to lean on anybody for anything. They got everything that they need right here in the United States. Whereas in Japan and England and some of the smaller countries, they've got to either colonize somebody else's land or something to survive. Because Japan, for example, they don't have any oil, coal, and they've got. And I think that my father always told me that, and he was quite a student on it, but he said that the Japanese government patterned themselves after the English than the United States because that they could see how, I guess the way they looked at it, because it was such a small island without any natural resources, and England solved their problem by doing what they did, and I think that's why the Japanese government is very similar to, as opposed to the United States. But I think that, when I look back in history, way back when the Phoenicians and, all the powers that went up and down to Italy, Portugal, Spain, and France, and Germany, and England, And I think those countries in Europe have peaked out, and well, they're not number one anymore. And then it eventually jumped the United States, and Japan, United States, I guess, probably the number one country in the world. But I think they've kind of peaked out too. And I think that it's going to jump across to the Pacific, and it's either going to go to Japan or China. But I think China has not the same status, so it may go to Japan, but then I think it'll go back into the Middle East and start all over again way after you and I are gone. But
Let me take you back to the war, you know, mm-hmm. and did you have any experience of them? You know, you were saying the war was over mm-hmm. by the time you went yes. in. Mm-hmm. You know, did you have a chance to go abroad at all?
Well, yes, I went to Europe, and the White administration of this camp in Arkansas, the man who was a personnel officer, was in the army when I got to Belgium at the replacement depot, and he was in charge of assigning people to different places. And he says, where do you want to go? I said, I don't know, where it's going to go. So we went out to dinner a couple of times. He says, look, he says, you're young and you're innocent, and I'll send you to Paris. So I went to Paris for about 8 or 9 months. And I was assigned to the office of chief engineer. And while I was there, as I said, I went over and picked up these prisoners over in England. And
what was that?
Yeah. Well, okay. These five black soldiers, okay, stole an army. Do you know what a duck is? These are amphibians, okay. And they had some gasoline in there, and they were going to go to the United States in that duck, okay, with a compass. And I don't know, there was a lot of, because the army was not integrated then, there was a lot of resentment. But anyway, they were in prison, and because they were in the units in France, that they brought them back. So I went over with about five or six other people, and we brought them back. But the colonel I had, the commander I had in Paris was very nice. He said, you ever been to England? I said, no. He said, well, he said, you know, why don't you stay over there a couple of weeks and look around? So we stayed there a couple of weeks and came, because things were pretty loose right after World War II, all over. So then after that, they had all these Hungarians that were they call them DP camps, okay? And they wanted to, or they were shipping them back to Hungary. And so I escorted them over there, you know, and train loads of them. And our office was responsible for disposing of military equipment. So I went to Sweden and got to go to Sweden and Italy and all over North Africa and places. I got a lot to do, a lot to try. I somehow, in that sense, that I was fortunate to get assignments that were pretty. I didn't have a high school degree when I was an officer. So I think that they realized that this guy can't do any engineering work. So they just sent me out and give me instructions on what to do. So I went to a lot of countries over there. And one of the things I found about in Europe, as far as I'm concerned, there was hardly any discrimination as far as I was concerned. I remember one of the early trips, I went up to up to Sweden and Norway, and people there they really didn't care who you were. They just made an opinion, formed an opinion of you, the way you present. They didn't care if you were white or pink or what, and that didn't exist in the United States. And because in the military, when they had black outfits and white organizations, you know, they inculcated everybody with the flag that here's the whites and so on. But in England and a lot of foreign countries, well, they didn't make any difference. And it was hard for, I talked to the army people over there, and it was hard for them to accept that. I know, have a friend that was who's black and who served in Europe. Yeah. What they did was in England, because of some social problem, they had curfews on the black soldiers, okay? American black soldiers. And these guys would go out and they get uniforms from the North African black soldiers that were in, that they're part of English army. You know, no, we're not United States, we're French Moroccans. But, you know, a thing like that, but...
Yes, I wonder what you thought of, you know, post-war Europe. Did you get an idea of what the war was like in the travels? You know, could you get
an
idea?
Yes. Well, if you want to talk about the physical, I saw all the bombing in Germany and all that sort of stuff. But my idea, wars are not fought for to free enslaved people and things like that. Wars are fought for economic plus ego.
Is that how you think of your Gulf War?
That's right. I do. No, I can't understand why Stalin and Churchill and you guys can't say, hey, look, you know, why do we want to slaughter all these people? But I think that, Hitler and Mussolini, it was their ego that made them do that. And not so much as, hey, we're going to, well, do what we can do for mankind. And if it was that, if that we're fighting a war to end all wars because of injustices of Hitler and Mussolini and all that stuff, and the next day we're going to go to war with Russia. You know, we've got this big build-up. The only thing we're building it up is to go fight Russia. When they, you know, when Gorbachev come in, and we're still going to spend millions and billions of dollars for military. And I just can't understand that. To me, I guess somebody said, if two people, you know, on one, if there are two people alive, they're going to fight, so it's inevitable. But
how about your recent Gulf War? You know, how do you look at that?
I think that was just a big, you know, I think that Bush knew that his popularity was going in. Because I can't understand activating 500,000 people go over and fight a third world country, okay? And if you look back, the United States is the only country since World War II has been out fighting war, right? Okay. Well, they went to Vietnam, for example, and the French were in there for 15 years and never did do anything. But the United States, well, we've been... You know, Korean War and all the other wars that we get. But I think that in some ways we've just got too much money and too much idle time and we got to do something. I'm very cynical, but I'm retired from the military and all that sort of thing. But still, I think there must be a better way than to go out and shoot each other.
You were saying earlier, George, you know, about the discrimination that existed in America, how Japanese people couldn't get citizenship and that sort of thing. Is it better today, do you think?
Well, it's a lot better today because I think, not because of legislation and laws. I think it's because I think we've proved ourselves. Okay? Right. Now, I go to these World of Difference meetings and things like that, and they talk, of course... the black people, I said, I don't sympathize with you guys too much. He said, why not? I said, I can remember, but when I was a kid, okay, I didn't get to go to segregated school like you did and all that sort of stuff. But I said that I can look back and say, like our parents say, if we study hard and be good, you know, model citizens, they're going to accept you. I remember when I was with the Air National Guard out here. Okay, I was the only non-white in that outfit because they wouldn't take blacks in. And finally, because the NAACP raised so much dickens that they brought this major in, black major in. And I told him, I said, now look, I said, what you do is going to mean whether other blacks can get in or not. He says, why not? Why? He says, because if you're a good guy, and they'll say, here's Major so-and-so, he's a good guy, so we'll bring him. And he said, George, why should I be better than the whites? I said, because that's the way the game is played. I says, it's unfair, but that's the way the game is. I can tell you, I was up at the end of my military service in Europe. I was in Berlin during the airlift. And I remember that one night we went to the officers' club. And in Berlin, for some reason, we were kind of an enclave up in those days, okay, there was the Russian zone, American zone, the French zone, English zone. And then Berlin was divided up in four sectors. And, and of course, the English and the French, and we this big officers club we go to, but they had, within the American side, they had different, they had Navy up there. And then, so one night we were sitting in the officers club, and one army could beat up six armies, something like that broke out. And we had a big brawl up in that officers club. They call out the military police. So a couple of days later, I get a call from from somebody from the general staff, and he said, "Could we see?" I said, "Yes." So I went up to where he was. He said, "I understand you were involved in this little fracas at the officers' club." I said, "Yes." I says, "We're about 2,000 others." He said, "You know why you're here?" I said, "No." He said, "The military police officer said, I can't identify anybody, but I do remember an Asian American." Okay. I said, "Well, I didn't do it all by myself." He said, "Do you know who?" I said, "Oh, no, I don't know who." I thought, boy. But in the same way, when I was Air National Guard here, one day the colonel said, "We're going to have a big meeting." Everybody had to be there, and for some reason I wasn't there. He called me in, and he said, "Hey, Sakaguchi, how come you weren't there?" I said, "Well, I was off the base and I was on official errand." But I knew that there were other officers who were not there. And I said, "Colonel, how come you pick on me?" I said, "I know that some of your hot pilots didn't show up at the meeting." He said, "Well, Sack, they used to call me Sack. Hey, Sack, I can still look around. If I don't hear a slant-eyed black kid, I know you're not there." No. So in that sense, because I know that I'm easily recognizable, I got to be careful, okay? Also, I think that we Japanese Americans want to always maintain a good side. We don't want to do anything because we know that if we're bad, all of the rest of us will be judged by the actions of us. And I think that's what makes us walk the straight and narrow.
That Berlin airlift, did you see much of the activity
in the airlift?
Relating? Yes.
Oh, yes. I was involved with the out the Tempelhof Airport where the armed military came in, and I was in charge of unloading airplanes. And I gave remember this story about this guy would put candy on a handkerchief and throw them out. Did you hear about that? Well, he started it, and what he did was he took a handkerchief and made a parachute out of it, and he tied bars of candy in. And he'd throw them out of the airplane because in those days they didn't have jets. Well, it got to be a big thing, and we'd all go out and buy candy and give them I was working at the Tempelhof Air Base, unloading air, in charge, kind of not in charge, but working with unloading airplanes. But there were some certain inconveniences, but I liked Berlin.
It must have been very busy, wasn't it? Were they coming in very regularly, the
aircraft? Yeah. See, because there was the British and the French and the Americans were involved in bringing, because they, have you been to Berlin? Okay, there's Tempelhof and there's another base called Gatow, I think, that was in the French sector. And I think the British were... Well, let's just say the United States carried the load on that because we went out and went over to Gatow one time and we saw one empty load and we unloaded and there's nothing but wine in there for the French people. We got kind of mad. But then yeah, I liked I enjoyed Germany a lot because that's where most of because eventually all the military people were taken out of England and France and moved into Germany because.
Was it quite a feat, do you think,
yes,
to
I think
feed
it was
that
quite
city in the during that mm-hmm. airlift?
It was. It was because the almost city of Berlin, except for the Russian sector, would totally depend on it, on the airlift to stay alive, and it was just day after 24 hours, 7 days a week there were airplanes coming in. It was quite a, I think, a great thing when you consider they didn't have the big aircraft that they have today, and it was, I think that was quite a thing, really.
Well, was there a fear at that time there might be another war with then? That airlift?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Well, in 19... The reason I left Paris, because I was an infantry officer, and there were, you know, we were going to go to war with Greece, and they said, the colonel said, George says, I got an order here, any infantry officer with more than 2 years left on his, we stayed there 3 years assigned, more than 2 years left on, you had to go join the, go back infantry officers, right? So I went with the 1st Infantry Division. We went up to, Greece, ready to fight. I had some confrontation between Yugoslavia and Greece or somebody that was going on. But I really didn't know, but we went. And then I know that, I think after the war, General Patton said, now we've beaten the Germans, now we ought to go up and beat the Russians because we're going to eventually fight the Russians. But, you know, when we were during the airlift, we swore that we were going to fight the Russians. Well, then, see, in 1962, our guard unit went over to Europe for 9 months because when they built that Berlin Wall. But I didn't. When I look back now, I don't think Russia was going to fight anybody, but they had everybody excited, and you know, made them commit all their resources to making sure. But now that I guess Gorbachev, and as soon as he gets rid of the old guard, they might. But I think, you know, I think men all over the world just wanting to fight. I mean, it's in nature.
Well, George, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your experiences in World War II. It's been very interesting. Thank you.
Well, the thing in this internment, I guess, going back, it makes it unique because it never happened to anybody else. Okay, and you're talking about within my life, some 50 years ago, and when the Iranians took over the embassy in Tehran, you know, they were going to round up all Iranians and put them in camp in the United States. Well, yes, they had a camp built in Mississippi for them. And so, I've been told that it's on the book for the government that they can do that. But not today with all, it's pretty, and we have, in the United States Senate, there are 2 Asian Americans in the United States Senate. There are no blacks, okay? And when they're in the House side, there are 3 Japanese Americans. Okay? But there are, of course, the Black Caucus, I think they have about 27, 28. People, but these people, you know, these Japanese Americans seem to have, well, Senator Inouye is number 3 in the Senate, and but so because of our record, of course, when from Hawaii, you know, if you're a Japanese American, you can't lose because you get all the votes, right? But the congressman from San Jose, Congressman Mineta, he was always, I guess, politically inclined. He started out as like, you know, alderman and went up. He became mayor of San Jose. And then he became United States congressman from that district. And then there's another one. And then, of course, I don't know if you ever heard of S.I. Hayakawa, the was semanticist. No, he's Canadian born. And then he went to California and he fought the hippies, so they made him senator. Of course, California. And they had Ronald Reagan and all these.
Oh, well, that's...